Bonjour aviators, and welcome to Ground Effect, the podcast for aviation enthusiasts, pilots, and student pilots. This is your host, Parimal. Our first guest is also an inspiration for this show. Antoine is the host of French language aviation podcast, Parlons Aviation. He's also an A320 pilot and has also had experience as an air traffic controller in Switzerland. We talk about his journey of being a pilot, the specificities of flight training in Europe, the notion of personal minimums, and also the differences between flying big jets and smaller general aviation aircraft. Now enjoy these few moments in Ground Effect with Antoine for that bit of extra lift for taking to the skies.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you loud and clear. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Wow, it's really interesting to hear your voice, and I'm so used to hearing your voice like accompanying me on my morning walks.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
it's really funny. Like for once, you're actually responding. Yeah, I can. Model it one way.
I am indeed a real person, not just a recording.
Okay, yeah, I didn't have proof before, but now I believe you. Or you're very good. You're a very, very advanced chatbot. I'll never know.
Yeah, that too. Who knows?
So thanks so much for accepting to do this. You're my very first guest.
Okay, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, well, I had already told our listeners that our first guest is an A320 pilot and a podcast host, a podcast that I listen to myself, and who has experience being an air traffic controller. So the idea today is to really get to know your story of how you got into aviation, your journey to being an A320 pilot, and really talk about a little bit about your plans for the future as well. But let's just start by just if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, well, you summed it up pretty well. I'm currently an A3 pilot for a low-cost airline in Europe. I've been in aviation pretty much all my life, so I don't really know how it got started because it's always been there. The little story is that my parents actually met on a glider field. My dad was a glider pilot, and my mother did fly gliders a few times, but she was mainly following her father, which was a glider pilot himself. So when I was a kid, I was just pretty much, playing around the gliders, the airplanes, and talking to people, hearing their stories. And so it's always been a pretty big part of my life. Then as I got a little bit older, we moved to the United States with my parents because I'm initially from the region of Paris. And my father got us started in making model airplanes and, well, initially model rockets, so which are available to buy very easily in the United States. You can go to a hobby store and buy some fairly powerful rockets. Okay. So initially we did that. That was great fun, but it ended when we set the field on fire, which wasn't the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure now there your parents are happy that you became a pilot and not a full-time rocket engineer. That was the other possibility.
Yeah, I guess it could have been a possibility, but yes, my early experiments didn't go too well in that field. I'm sure, you know, I was a kid at this point. I was maybe 11 or 12, maybe, so... I can only imagine how scared my father was to have set a field on fire. For as a kid, it was, I remember it as a fairly entertaining, maybe a little bit worrying, but mainly entertaining.
But mainly
experience.
Entertaining.
But as an adult, must have been absolutely awful.
Yeah, no, that's yeah, and they probably wanted to steer you more towards aviation. But so you started. You were the third generation glider pilot in your family then, very very young.
Yeah, so I start indeed. Once we did the model airplane thing, then we came back to France, and I did still a bit of model airplanes. But the main thing I started doing was flying gliders. So my father had been part of a glider club for I don't know how many years it had been at this point, but he started flying around 16, and now he's 50 something, and he's actually still the president of that club. So I started flying the gliders because my parents paid for it, and it was a very enjoyable activity. And I eventually, after I think a year and a half of flying gliders, I earned my glider pilot license. And then I kept on flying to obtain what we call the flying cross-country checkout.
Right. And how many hours do you need for that?
It's not so much a number of hours. As far as I remember, you had to do three things. You had to fly 5 hours in a row, which is a very long time when you're not cross-country checked out in a glider. It's not so much a challenge in terms of staying up there. It's at this point, it's more a challenge of endurance.
Right.
And then you had to do plus 1,000 meters in a flight, which was fairly easy if you have the right kind of weather. And you would have to do 50 kilometers, go somewhere, and then come back another 50 kilometers. So I had actually done the 1,000 meters. That was fairly easy. The 5 hours was grueling, but I got it done. And then I just had to log the 50 kilometers, because not only do you have to do it, you have to take a GPS logger with you to prove that you've actually done it.
Oh, wow. And you're doing this solo, right?
Yes, of course. Yes. All this has to be done solo. Yes.
Okay. Okay. So you got that. And you were how old when you did this?
So this was right at the end when I actually stopped flying. So when I went to engineering school, so I must have been 18 something.
Okay.
All 18 right. or 17, I guess.
Okay. So you got your license for gliders. And then how long did that take you to go into fixed wing, motorized, planes?
Well, actually, it took me quite a long time, because once I was done with the glider flying and once I was done with high school, then my parents were paying for my engineering studies, so they couldn't afford to pay for my glider flying.
Right.
So I stopped flying gliders for actually flying at all, in fact, for a good 5 years, something like that. And then I had the chance at the very end of my engineering study, which was 5 years, to go work for Dassault Aviation, which is the company that makes the Dassault Fokker jets and the Rafale,
right,
which my father works on. So I went to work for the Rafale, and then I kind of got into the model flying again and did quite a lot of it for about a year. Then I wanted to be a pilot, because I had done the engineer thing, because that's what I did after my high school, and that was the only thing accepted me in terms of admissions and things like this.
Right.
So I did the engineering thing, and at the end I said, okay, now I want to become a pilot. And I looked at the money that I was making as a beginner engineer in Paris in regards to how much it costs to actually become an airline pilot nowadays, and it just there was no possibility of it happening. And I saw that the air traffic control service for Switzerland, which is called SkyGuide, they were hiring people with no conditions of nationality. So I applied. They said, okay, you're hired.
Oh, cool.
So I went into training for them. And then as part of the training for an air traffic controller, they would pay about 25 hours of my PPL. So that's how I got started flying motorized airplanes. And it was great fun, because it was not so much about getting the actual PPL curriculum done. It was more about, you know, flying around, getting to know airplanes.
Right.
Because when you do air traffic control training, you don't really need that much knowledge, in fact, about the airplane. But you really do need it if you want to be a good air traffic controller. So it was awesome. We went, so we were flying in Sion. It was February, but we went to Corsica, to Montpellier, to Tessin, which is the southern part of
Switzerland. Oh, that must have been brilliant.
Yeah, that was absolutely fantastic. We did mostly, you know, cross-country flying all around France. It was awesome fun. So that's how I got started flying again.
Okay, and when you're a controller, right? Like, did you go in that route because you said, well, I can't start flying immediately. It unfortunately does cost a bit of money. But you said, hey, I want to stay in aviation one way or another. And you said, okay, well, this is one way to do it. Was that your logic reasoning, or was that?
Yeah. Well, I kind of, since I was a kid, if you ask a 10-year-old Antoine, what does he want to do later on in life, then he would have answered, well, first I'd like to be an airline pilot. If I can't, then I'll be an air traffic controller. And if I can't, then I'll be an engineer like my father.
Okay. Yeah, it's quite a rational choice when you see it like that. And you're probably the only person I know who had a 3-step plan as a kid when someone asked you, what do you want to be when you had fail safes. That's good. No, but it's you know, I'm a student pilot, like just shy of 10 hours, and it's true. It's a lot of money. So even 25 hours, you know, that's half your training. If you do it very quickly, that's a big deal.
Yeah, I'm not sure how informed I was about the flight training opportunities as part of an air traffic control. I thought it was a good plan. It sounded like an interesting job. Plus, it would be able to fund flight training. Whether I would have gone professional if I had succeeded the training all the way, I don't know at this point. It's difficult to say, but for sure, I would be definitely flying at least leisurely.
Right, on your own. Now, since you got into, you became an air traffic controller having already flown, is that common among controllers to also have flying experience and be private pilots, for example?
I can only speak from my experience in the case of the people who I was with in training. I would say about 1/3 to half of the people who were in air traffic control training had already some flight experience to varying degree. Only a few had PPLs, but you had some that had what we call the basic license. So that's what we have in France, which is kind of the equivalent of the LAPL that we have now in Europe. But it's much simpler. You can't go really on cross countries and things like this. But it allows you to fly solo, and it's one exam that you can pass fairly easily. So some people had some varying degrees of flying experience, but most didn't have that really anything. And that's kind of the surprising thing, maybe, in terms of air traffic control, that people don't think it, that you have plenty of air traffic controllers who enjoy their job but aren't really big fans of aviations, that don't go out flying every weekend. You have some that really do, and some very passionate people, of course, but it's kind of half and half, I would say, from my experience.
With aviation, it's the same thing with you. You've got your podcast as well. We'll talk about that in a bit. The people I tend to run into in flying clubs, which are, as you know, extremely common in France, I get the sense that they're very passionate about it. They're not just flying just to, you know, go to an airport, fly and go home. You give a pilot or a certain pilot the opportunity to talk about planes, and they'll go on. you can be instantly friends with anyone because there seems to be a lot of passion in this industry.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. That's one of the reasons why I like it so much. Of course, when you go into more of the professional aspects of the industry, you will find varying degrees of passion. Some people will just have their job, either an airline pilot or air traffic controller, and just go home after the day, not think twice about airplanes. But you have some people who are who have varying degrees of addiction to this to this area. And I think I'm on the more addicted side of this spectrum for sure.
Yeah, I think I with what little I know about you, I would also, if I can, you know, allow myself to put you in that category. But you know, one of the things that was quite difficult for me starting was talking to air traffic controllers, the radio work, and over time it becomes easier. But the first time you have to sort of, you know, key the mic and say, you know, I'm a DR-400 on this parking lot, and you want clearance to start taxiing. Your heart really sinks because you know that, you know, you're in a frequency with so many people, and they all seem to know what they're saying, and you are trying to memorize your sentence, that which, you know, invariably you forget after pressing the button. But you have seen, sort of been on both sides. What do you think? What would you say to a beginning sort of pilot who has sort of scared of talking on the radio?
To try to practice offline. You have these solutions such as Live ATC. You can buy a portable radio for not too much money and then start listening in, because it is quite repetitive. It's a little bit more complicated when you fly VFR because you have more stuff that you can't possibly say, more negotiations with air traffic control.
Right.
It gets easier for the IFR part because it's all very codified and it's always the same thing. So Live ATC is a good solution. I also, when I was a little bit younger, I would fly on the flight simulator networks, which is called the IVAO.
Right.
IVAO, so, air traffic control online. I think that can help as well. It's only to a point because it's fairly casually done.
Yeah. And then my instructor essentially told me, you just, you know, you press the button, you speak, and you know, they'll understand you. The controllers are, they know you're training. So unless the traffic is really heavy, they're not going to be they're going to be understanding in one way or another, and that kind of helped me. So I've gotten better over the last few flights.
Yeah, and I think your instructor is absolutely right. I mean, even as professional pilots, sometimes we get it wrong. We say stupid things. It happens to everybody. So you can have anyone who's watched this movie, The Right Stuff, or Apollo 13, has this idea of the, you know, the mission controllers being very professional, straightforward. Everybody the same voice. In fact, that's not really what it's like in real life. Even as a professional pilot, sometimes we get it wrong. Sometimes the readback is incorrect, and it's okay. Especially as a student pilot, you're not gonna learn this in a few minutes. It's gonna take a little while, and that's perfectly fine. But what is sure is that it's a very important skill later on when you go on cross countries, when you're asking for clearances through airspace that is maybe class Delta or above. Your level of phraseology is the only thing the controller can use to gauge how proficient you are and how much you can they can cooperate with you. So it's also a very important aspect that you build over time, and it's important to keep building after you obtain your license because it is very important. And if you have good phraseology, you will notice that air traffic controllers will tend to grant you more things.
Oh, that's a really good thing to know. And also, of course, you've got the huge issue of safety, where a lot of the things that we do when we're flying VFR, we do have this sort of notion of see and avoid. And if you're not constantly being aware of other planes in your frequency, your situational awareness is going to suffer from that. So, I hear you when you say you keep working on it. It's something that's going to add a lot of value to your flying. Okay, so let's go back to your initial training. So you were in to Switzerland. This was in Geneva, or?
So we went to Sion, which is a city in the middle of the Alps, basically, probably 200 kilometers away from Geneva. So there it was a little busy and much easier to get flight training done.
Cool. And so how long did that last for you, that PPL stage of your training?
So the part that I did as part of my air traffic controller training, it lasted, for, if I remember correctly, it was 4 to 5 weeks.
Okay.
Well, fortunately, unfortunately, depends how you see things, but I was unemployed at that point. So I took basically, I was looking for a job and doing the PPL training during that time. So it was probably another 3 months, something like this, to complete the rest of the other 20 somewhat hours that I needed to complete it.
Okay, so it went fairly quickly, nevertheless. I mean, the situation wasn't perfect, but you at least had time.
Yeah, that is one of the few benefits of being unemployed. you do have time. And I was lucky enough to, my wife helped out, and she was a huge help to getting me where I am today and throughout the whole process.
Okay, so you pass your PPL training, you're in Sion, you're now a licensed pilot flying. I suppose what sort of plane were you training on? Was it a Robin or?
Yeah, exactly. All my primary training I did in Robin DR400, so different variants, 120, 160, and 180 horsepower. And once I got my license, I got checked out on pretty quickly on a Piper Archer 180 with the glass cockpit, the Avidyne.
Oh, cool.
That was a nice step, kind of up, I guess. It's not as nice to fly the Piper Archer. I gotta say that the Robin is absolutely blast to fly, and it's very easy. The Archer is kind of heavier. The takeoff performance is not half as good as the Robin, it seems.
Okay, but it's quite funny. The Robin, the DR400, is for me, it's almost like the French or almost the European Cessna 172, which is the aircraft that you fly if you're anywhere doing flight training in the United States and many other countries. It is the most produced aircraft. But most places I know in Europe with flying clubs are fly on a DR400.
Yeah, for sure. The Robin is definitely something you see everywhere in Europe, and honestly, for good reason. It is a very nice and light aircraft. It's I'm sure it's quite easy to maintain, provided that you have the woodworking skills, because its structure is made out of wood instead of metal compared to all the American trainers that I know of. So it's definitely something you see everywhere. If you go into specific flying clubs, you'll find that you also have some air clubs that will do initial training on Cessna 152s, 172s, but those are not as common as the ones that do on the Robin. And now you have maybe the more modern air clubs have the Technam, either the P2002, P2008, that they'll do a primary flight training on, because it has the MOGAS engine.
Right, so they're cheaper and they have the Rotax MOGAS engine. So that makes a big difference when you're soon as well.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. When it's eating 2 times less fuel, then that's pretty nice.
Yeah. All right. So you get your license. What's your next step?
Yeah. So once you get to PPL, you have to get two things started. Right? So you have to start building hours, because you need a certain number of hours for IFR training, then the commercial license, the CPL. So that needs to get started fairly quick, and you need to build experience, becoming more proficient, because as the Americans say all the time, and I think it's very correct, that the PPL is nothing more than a license to learn. You become proficient enough to be able to go learn on your own. So that's the main part. It's also a very fun part, which is probably the most fun I've had in a small airplane, was the hour building. And then in parallel to that, you need to get started on the ATPL theory exams. It's quite a difficult task, because you start the ATPL training, you don't really know what to expect. What most people will have in mind is they'll have the PPL theory test that they passed, but truth is that ATL theory has nothing to do with that. It's about 25 to 30 kilos of books. So that's a lot of material to learn. It's depending how you do it. Some people will do it full time as part of a training school. Some people will do it full time on their own. And some other people like me will do it in parallel to their job. And any way you do it, it's very difficult. It's a lot of work. You got to really learn a lot of stuff. It's a little bit unfortunate that at this point, when you're doing the theory, a lot of things will seem maybe a little bit useless or not directly applicable. But in fact, the further you go on, and if you go to the airlines, to the IFR training and all these things, a lot of things will make more sense and will seem more useful. But initially, it's a little bit hard to learn because of this.
So there's a lot of information that you don't really know the context in which they'll be useful. So you tend to think, oh my God, they're just trying to make it harder for me. And as you have more experience in more complex flying, you say, well, you know, actually, maybe it wasn't all that bad.
Yeah, exactly. That's very well.
So you did the ATPL, and how long did that take you?
So as I did in parallel to my job, most people will do it in about 18 months to 2 years, depending on personal circumstances. So I did it in 14 months, just about. But of course, I was lucky to have the air traffic control training that had a lot of theory in it. Basically, we did 6 months theory. A lot of it was inspired, at least, by the ATPL theory. So thanks to what I've done as an air traffic controller, I had a rough idea of quite a few things. So it was a little bit easier for me. But most people that do it in parallel to their job will do it in 18 months, more or less, depending on the circumstances.
Okay. And is this program, so you've got the ATPL, is it integrated to your CPL and your IR sort of instrument rating and the multi-engine, or do you do these things separately?
That's a good question. In the US, you will have different written exams for different ratings. In Europe, we have a little bit different system. Basically, the ATPL exam is the cover it all, except the PPL written exam. So once you have your ATPL theory exam, you can more or less go on to practical training for just about any other license that I know of.
So is that what you did? So you did your ATPL ground, and then you did your instrument. Did you start with your instrument rating, or did you start with your commercial?
Yes, so I did. You will find, depending on the flight school, that some people will start with the IFR training and some people will start with the commercial pilot license. I did the instrument rating first. The advantage of that is the hours that you do as part of your instrument rating training will count towards your commercial pilot license. So you will have to do less hour per building as a PPL. So it's of course not going to give you some pilot and command time, but it will give you some normal instruction time. So that's kind of the choice. Some schools do it one way, some do it the other way. Honestly, for me, it's either way is fine. So I did the instrument rating first. So depending on the school, once again, you can either do single engine IFR. Then I did the commercial pilot license.
So after you have all your ratings and you've got the ATPL, I guess you're thinking about the airlines.
Yeah, definitely. So once you have your commercial pilot license, you're going to need one other part of training. Sometimes I find when I discuss with students, it's a little bit overlooked. And I think that's really unfortunate because during this whole time from the instrument rating, even the private pilot instrument rating to even the twin engine, you're flying fairly small planes. The twin engine airplanes are a little bit bigger, of course, but it's four, maybe six seater if you're lucky. That's what the flight school has. So you have this this transition phase in the training, which is called the MCC GOC for multi crew cooperation and the jet orientation course. There are different variants of it, but it's for me it was definitely the most enjoyable part of the training. So this block. During this block, you will learn how to fly with another crew member. So up to this point, you're flying all alone. So it is tricky because you have to learn a lot of things, but it's not as tricky in terms of a human aspect and a CRM aspect. This is what we talk about all the time at the airlines. So you have to learn this, plus you have to learn how do I fly a really complex aircraft. So an aircraft that needs to be flown by two people, it's not just for fun. It's because it is complicated enough that it's necessary. In most situations, and especially in emergency situations, you need to be two people. And you have to learn how to work together. You have to learn how to manage the jet. You have to learn how to manage the systems, the failures. And that takes a lot of work. And the regulatory minimums are actually fairly small. You can do only 10 hours simulator as a pilot flying and 10 hours as pilot monitoring. So that's only 20 hours. So that's not very much. So what my flight school did and what a lot of other flight schools do, they'll offer you more extended courses where you go maybe 50, 60 hours in a simulator. And that was, first of all, it's a lot of fun because you're learning very quickly. You're learning to fly a medium jet, and that's lots of fun. And it's also very interesting to start working with another person and know the dynamic and start troubleshooting fairly complex situations. I found that absolutely incredibly interesting. It was lots of fun, probably the most fun I've had in the training.
Oh wow, that's high praise. I mean, yeah, I suppose if you're going to be spending the majority of your time in airline flying with somebody, either as the captain or the first officer, I imagine it's worth. And not, you know how to fly the plane now. How do you fly the plane with someone else and not get in the way and be efficient? So I guess that's an important part. I myself didn't really know about this module, so thanks for that.
I mean, this is what I think. It's of course, this is my opinion, but people will think that once you know how to fly an airplane, a DA-42, which is the twin-engine trainer that most flight schools have these days, right, that you'll be able to just hop on a 737 and do 10-hour simulator and be proficient. I mean, that does sound a little bit absurd when you present it like this, but when I talk to students and some people who have done their training, then That is kind of what they tend to think. I do understand that the training is very expensive, so you try to make it as cheap as possible. But in my opinion, if there is one part of the training that you should maybe pay a little bit less attention in terms of cost and maybe go the extra expenses, it is MCC GOC, because it is not that easy to fly a medium jet initially. Once you get used to it, and if you ask people that are doing it every day, they'll say it's easy. But it does take some getting used to, and it is not trivial because, well, it goes fast and it's very sensitive. If you're flying a Robin and you make pitch inputs of 2 or 3 degrees, then you'll still be fine. You'll be able to catch up and it's fine. Right. But if you make that sort of mistake on a jet that's flying a lot faster, then you're going to be outside the ideal flying envelope fairly quickly.
You find yourself in positions where you're behind the aircraft, and of course when you're traveling at that speed, that's not ideal.
Yeah, this is every time you step into something new that's a little bit faster, a little bit more complicated, you'll be behind, and that's normal. Of course, the next step is the harder step. Once you've done this and you're done with the actual initial training, then you have to go to an airline, then you have to go through the selection process, and you can be pretty sure that they'll have a simulator exam. And if right. The more you're proficient at this part of the training, which is, in my opinion, very important, then the more you'll be able to you know, be good and to pass airline selection training in the simulators. And I think that's really worth a lot.
Okay, that's a very interesting perspective. Later on, in about a month or so, I'll be traveling to Nepal. I'm going to be talking to pilots who fly both jets, so A320s probably, and also to pilots who fly sort of mountain routes, so that they're flying on really high altitude mm-hmm. airports, still flying mostly VFR, in quite complex conditions, but very, very different, of course, than flying a jet. What is for you the biggest difference between flying a jet and flying a small plane, which you continue doing?
This is what some instructors will say when you're doing type rating. They'll tell you, yeah, it's just another airplane, and you're like, yeah, right. And initially you're thinking, oh, no, it's not just another airplane, because it's taking me a month to learn how to fly it, and it's taking me so much effort. But, you know, once you get used to it, they're right. And even the Airbus, which has a lot of nice features, it's now a fairly old aircraft because it's 30 years old.
Of course.
But it has all these nice features. But in the end, really, it is just another airplane. So when we fly the jet, there's a book of rule that's many hundreds of pages that's telling you what you can do, what you should do, what you shouldn't do. When you're flying the small airplanes, the rule book is actually fairly small, so you have to make up your own rule. And this is where they have this saying in the United States, they say it's not because it's legal that it's a good idea. And I think that's very true in, well, all aspects of life, in fact, but especially when you're flying as a private pilot. There are many things that are illegal. The biggest thing, in my opinion, is VFR minimums, which are really, really low. In fact, if you're straight out of PPL training, if it's just VFR minimums, you shouldn't be flying, in my opinion. And honestly, even today, if I was flying a small airplane, I would not go out flying in VFR minimums.
Right. So Right, so that's interesting because one of the notions that I'm learning about as I'm learning to fly is this notion of personal minimums, and you know your aircraft might have a demonstrated crosswinds sort of capability at 22 knots, but if I say, hey, you know what, I'm in a very early part of my training, I'm not going to push it beyond 10, and that is my personal minimum, and if it's 11. Sure, the aircraft can handle it, and maybe I can handle it too because you know I've had some experience. But no, it's beyond my personal minimum. I'm going to go to my alternate, and that's something that sort of I've been trying to keep in mind as well. And I guess this is true even if you're much more experienced by it, and you have minimums that are different, but you still have them.
Yeah, for sure. And even you see in my case, so I'm flying the Airbus day to day. And my personal minimums flying the smaller airplanes are actually maybe higher than a number of people who fly that don't have IFR licenses and things like this. Because I'm flying the Airbus all day long, but that doesn't mean I'm very proficient in the smaller airplanes. I mean, if I have tomorrow to do 15, 20 knot crosswind in a Cessna, well, I'm not going because I don't feel proficient enough. And the times I've been going and I've been getting more and more busy in my personal life, I've unfortunately less time and also less money to fly the small airplane. So my personal minimums have actually gone higher. So it needs to be better for me to fly now than when I was maybe 100 hours PPL. So that's also something you have to recognize. How are your skills at one point or another, and the risk you're willing to take in the end, that's what you're evaluating.
Right, and that's something that that's constantly sort of drilled into even when you're a student. Sort of safety is the most important aspects. But let me ask you, so what's your favorite thing about flying the Airbus versus the favorite thing about flying a small general aviation aircraft?
Well, my favorite thing about flying Airbus is that's my job.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
That's the nicest thing. That's kind of, it may seem trivial, but in fact, there's a lot to that. I'm lucky enough that I was hired by an airline that is that's very nice, that I really enjoyed. That was the airport is 15 minutes away from my home.
Oh, that's right.
So I go to the airport. I don't have to commute or take an airplane to go to work or fly standby or drive 4 hours like some people do. So that's already a huge chance, in my opinion. That makes a huge difference in this job.
Okay, so that's for the Airbus. What about the smaller aircraft then?
Yeah, I like the small aircraft because you just get up and go. You know, tomorrow, if I want, I'm still checked out for a little while. I can, take the airplane, and if I wanted to go to Corsica, then let's go. We go tomorrow. I fly the flight plan. We look at the route, and we plan a hotel, and that's it. We're gone. So there is this thing that's very nice, and it is, you can go. I mean, I fly a Cessna 182 on the side, and it's going as 145 knots true airspeed. So that is pretty fast airplane, in my opinion, for a small airplane. So you can go anywhere you'd like. You know, you say tomorrow I'd like to see the Mont Blanc up close, then you just drive through the airport, start up the airplane. I still find it incredible today, actually.
No, it is in many ways incredible, and how, in my experience, so when I discovered flying clubs, the Aero Club here in France. I was surprised by how open and welcoming they were and how easy it was to just get started. Like, you would go there, they would visit, and you set up a date, and you start flying. But one thing I remember from your podcast was that you were impressed by the FBOs and the services that you have in the US in some airports where you're really well received. They refuel your aircraft. I was wondering what for you was the biggest difference between flying in Europe, sort of VFR, general aviation flying, versus in the United States.
Those are both two very different experiences. I enjoyed them both, and the biggest difference is definitely these FBOs. When you go in Europe, you know, you go to a very big airport. Well, first of all, you probably can't go. If you want to go to, you know, one of the big Paris airports, you want to go to Le Bourget, then you simply are not welcome.
Yes, yeah.
As a VFR airplane, because we have class Alpha.
Right.
But if you want to go as IFR, because the airplane is IFR equipped, then you're going to be paying 400, 500, 600 euros for just landing, staying there for a few hours. That's how much it's going to cost.
Oh, really?
You
so 400, 500 with the parking and every landing fees. Wow, I didn't realize it was that high.
Because what we call it here, it's mandatory handling. So you have to work with a handling agent. And, you know, these guys are handling business jets that are 10, 15, 20 tons. So they're not they don't want you here because you're not buying much fuel, you're not providing much, you're not buying many services. So the idea is that they made the cost of entry very high so that you simply don't come. And this is an issue with a number of fairly big airports. If you want to go to Nice, for example, you have this issue. Some airports will have exceptions for clubs that are based locally or, you know, days where they'll accept you. But in these cases, the message is pretty clear.
Right.
But still, in France, we are lucky because a number of big airports will allow you to come in. You know, I've been to Toulouse, the main airport where you have Airbus. So they kind of accept you, but there is no AFGAS, so you have to plan. And but you can land, and it's not that expensive.
Okay.
In fact, I never got the billing. So
that's lucky.
But the pricing was not that high. It was maybe 30 euros. So, you know, and the thing is, if you come with a small airplane and you go to Toulouse or you go to Montpellier, then you're in the middle of nowhere. There's nobody that's gonna, you know, come help you. If you want fuel, then it's gonna be complicated. If there is even fuel on that airport. So you're kind of lost, basically. If you want a rental car, then you have to walk. Maybe, you know, an airport's pretty big, so you can walk several kilometers to go to the passenger terminal. And it's not an efficient way to travel. Well, in US, it's actually the exact opposite of this. You know, you pull up to just about any FBO, you say, hey, I want a rental car, and please fuel the plane to the top off, and that's it. In 5 minutes later, you're outside the airport with a rental car and everything's arranged. And that makes a really big difference when you're wanting to travel. And that really changes everything. And you don't have, well, I think a few really big airports have these handling fees and higher landing fees, but it is something that's quite marginal. We went with my wife, we went to Las Vegas International, which is like 10 biggest airports in the United States. It was very, very easy. You just get a clearance to land, park at the FBO. They park the airplane, fuel it up, and you got the rental car, and that's very nice. You got to admit.
Okay, so I'm gonna add that to my bucket list to be able to land at LA at some point in the future. No, but it's true because I train at an airfield called Logne, not very far from Paris. But you know, I don't have a car, so I'm spending about an hour and 30 minutes more or less just to get there. I'm spending at least 2 hours going there and back. And I'm flying for about an hour, and then with the ground another hour. So it's a huge chunk of my time. And I suppose if you're coming into Paris, you know, from elsewhere in Europe, which is cool that you can do that. You know, you're probably going to be landing in one of these smaller airports. And if you don't have a car, you're going to have to either find a taxi, figure that out, or just take public transportation. And it does take a bit of time. So I guess that is, you have to think about that when you think about traveling by aircraft.
Yeah, for sure, definitely.
Right. So now you're an A320 pilot. You also have your own podcast. So what was your motivation for starting that? I mean, I know, but perhaps our listeners are going to be interested in. And I'm going to put a link to your podcast, Parlons Aviation, in the episode description.
Well, there is the official answer to that, and there is maybe the unofficial answer to that. The official answer, the official answer that I will usually give is that, you know, I'm always talking about aviation, and my wife is quite a recipient of a significant portion of that. So she's a little bit tired, you know, sometimes. We've been together for a number of years now, and you know, she gets a little tired of hearing me talk about airplanes. So I kind of said, okay, I'll talk aviation, which is exactly the name of the podcast in English. I'll just make a podcast. It's called Talking Aviation, so I can talk aviation well by myself with maybe if somebody else wants to listen, that will be nice. So that's kind of the official answer, and I enjoy sharing the passion and getting people motivated in aviation. If I can, you know, help people get started flying or just grow their interest in aviation, then I'm happy if I've contributed to that. The unofficial answer is that I had a lot of free time and I was looking for something to do to occupy some of my free time. I don't want to, you know, get the idea that as airline pilots, we have so much free time, we don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
But it is fairly seasonal business. So during the winter and nowadays in June and May, we fly quite a lot. But, you know, during the winter months, it does go down quite a bit. So I was a little bit bored looking for something to do. You know, I enjoy technology. I was an IT engineer before. And so I was, you know, thinking about maybe making some website. I'd done difficult projects. And my wife said, I was always listening to podcasts when I was going to work as an engineer. So she said, why don't you make a podcast? That'd be a good idea. You could, you know, keep busy a little bit, do interesting stuff. And I said, oh, that's true. That's a good idea. And that's how it was. That is the unofficial answer. It's not as nice, but
no. I think. Well, in any case, I know from my experience that you'll have to thank your wife for me because. I look for podcasts as you did, I imagine, to go to work. You want to sort of be connected to aviation as much as possible, and I really enjoy listening to your podcast. It's really, really well organized, and you've got your news for the week, and you've got your the main part. You take a topic, or you bring a guest like Vincent the last time. So I feel like it's really, really well organized, and of course for me that's. Your podcast is one of the reasons that I thought, hey, you know what? We don't have a lot of content in English for sort of in a European context. And I had the same sort of thinking, so why don't I just give it a shot? You know, and this is, I'm new at this, but I thought, you know, let's give it a shot. So I suppose your podcast has been very successful in that regard as well.
Yeah, thank you. No, I'm blushing. I appreciate the nice comments. You know, I have no idea. When I started this podcast, I had no idea how to do much of any of the audio stuff. And the public speaking, this is something that I enjoy. But in fact, podcasting is quite a bit different from that. It's kind of the same idea, but except you're on your own, so it's a little bit hard. And the initial podcasts weren't too great. Now, if I listen to them again, I do realize that. But that's okay. You got to start somewhere, and people didn't leave straight away, so I guess it wasn't that bad.
Well, there's the content and stuff as well. No, and of course, and I'm the same. I've had so much audio problems with this podcast, and I do apologize to my listeners. The next podcast will have better quality, but I'm certainly very, very happy with the quality of the content that we've had. So thank you so much, Antoine, for taking the time in your busy schedule to talk to us. Do you have any last comments for our listeners? I don't know if they're going to be mostly in Europe or in the US or elsewhere, but any last words?
Well, first of all, I'd like to wish you good luck on your podcast. It sounds, I think it's a great idea, and it could definitely interest a lot of people. And if you're thinking about starting in aviation, just go for it. You don't have to take flying lessons. There are many things to do in aviation that are maybe a little bit less expensive or more accessible, depending on what you can access in your local area. But it's a very passionate field, full of passionate people, where everybody's gonna want to help you out. And if you just ask, go to an airport, start talking with people, and I think most everybody's happy to help you out if you just have a simple interest in aviation. Yeah. And that's really nice, and we're very fortunate to have that.
Yeah, that's certainly been my experience as well. Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to another episode of Fado Aviation as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the first episode of Ground Effects, our new aviation podcast. I'd like to thank Antoine for his time and for sharing his experience. I'm fairly new at this podcasting business, so do let me know what you thought of the episode, how I can improve it, and if you have ideas for future episodes, you'll find my contact information at groundeffect.fm. Our next guest is also quite special, my flight instructor. We'll be talking to him about his very unique journey into aviation and how he became a flight instructor. Stay tuned for that on iTunes or wherever else you're listening to this podcast. And until then, happy flying, or as we say in French, bon vol, au revoir.